Rato. When she? She's still in the queue. Oh, okay. Or in the visitor center. Oh, okay. Or she'll join at any time from now. No, that's fine. Thank you so much. We are in yet another session now, wherein we're looking at our annual report. This is the BRRR process. Who are those youngsters there? Yes, let them identify themselves and introduce themselves. It's always good to have youngsters among ourselves. We really enjoy having you, but we need to know who you are. I'm told that you are from PMG. Can you introduce others, please?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Sia from PMG. I have Musa, she's training, and also Gwen. Neo,
Gwen.
And Gwena.
Oh.
All
right. They are all training.
Yes.
Oh, okay. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much. Sia, can you switch off your mic, please?
Oh,
thank you. Yes, we yet again looking at our audit outcomes plus the annual performance of the competition tribunal. This actually kickstarts the all other entities plus the department's annual performance and audited statements reviewal by the committee. We've been with you for quite some time now. This actually marks our last year of the term, that is the fifth parliament term. So this should be a very important meeting to all of us. You might see some of us next year, you might not see some of us next term, not next year necessarily. When I say next year, I mean next term, which is the sixth parliament. So when looking at the report, it's quite pleasing to see that there's a lot of improvements on the side of, and some consistencies actually on the side of the tribunal. We really would like to commend you for that. Once again, achieved unqualified audit opinion with no, which is actually clean audit. We want to congratulate you for that. It really encourages to see such a performance. You'll see members also when we look at other entities and the department that there's been quite a tremendous improvement in the performance. So we really are encouraged by that, and the fact that when we look at the advice you got from the committee, you really try to implement such recommendations you got from the committee. We would like to thank you for that. I've gone through your report, and I know that other members have, and I'm glad that you summarized that also through the presentation that you'll be making. And we are looking forward to hearing the whole presentation and challenges that you're facing, especially also in the midst of the amendments of the Competition Act, and see whether there are areas where we can still look at together so that we are able to strengthen yourselves, because this process is very important, because it's a reviewal process. It's not only for us, finding faults. It's is for every one of us, you know, sharing and being able to advise and also to grow from the discussions that we'll be having. Thank you so much. Peter Paul, can you deal with the apologies, please?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, for the record, we wish to register three apologies that have been received from the members, these being Ms. Matsimbi and Mr. Tliane from the African National Congress, who are not here due to academic commitments, as well as Ms. Hlonyana, who is informed us that she's attending to party duties. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Peter Paul. So others would say, oh, Dr. Kaido?
Chair, Mr. Atkinson indicated to me that he'd be half an hour late.
Okay. Thank you for that. Otherwise, yeah, those who haven't given the secretary written apologies are said to be absent from work because we don't know their whereabouts. Thank you so much. May we then take this opportunity and hand over to Mr. Manoim for the presentation.
Chair, thank you very much, Chair and members. If I can just introduce our delegation, although I think you know us well. I'm Norman Manoim, the chairperson. On my left is Janine de Klerk, our chief operating officer. And on my right is Lerato Motoong, who I must say a bit about because she is formerly our registrar. She has sadly is going to be leaving us and going into business on her own. So she's learnt about competitiveness and has decided to get into the economy. So we are very sad to be losing her. She has more than 20 years of public service in the competition authorities, not at first in the tribunal, then the predecessor of the competition board. But it's also, we respect her decision to go into the private sector, and I'm sure she's going to do as well as she's done with us. We have appointed a new registrar, Tebogo Mputle, who's going to start on the 1st of November. So the next time we are here, we'll introduce her to the committee. And she has been previously employed by the tribunal, so she will, as they say, hit the ground running, knowing the familiar with our systems. So if I can just, the way we've organized the presentation, we do a case review, a performance review, financial overview, then describe the challenges, and then a conclusion for your questions. If we can go then on to, I'll pass on to Lerato, who will do the case review highlights.
Morning, Chair, morning, members, and my apologies for being late. I was just stuck in a bit of traffic. I'll quickly just go through the case review, the highlights for the 2017-2018 year. And we'll mainly look at the measures as well as prohibited practices, which would you refer to as complaints from either the Commission or from private parties. Okay, and in terms of measures in the 2017-2018 year, we decided on 124 measures, and in the prior year, we actually decided on a bit less because it was 105. And we approved 37 measures with conditions, and then you'll see in the prior year, it was only 19, and we, out of the 37, 25 of them had public interest conditions. In the prior year, there were only 8 with public interest conditions. And out of that 37, 22 of them had employment conditions, and as opposed to the previous year, which only had 8. Then this is just a, just a diagram just showing the comparison from 2017-18 and 2016-17. Can we move on? Okay. In terms of measures, we are, in terms of the rules and the Act, we required to decide on measures within 60 business days of the matter being lodged with the Commission. So the 40 days normally would refer to the period that the Commission has to investigate a matter. That excludes any extensions that are granted. And once the Commission refers a matter to us, we as a tribunal have 10 days to set the matter down for hearing. And once we've concluded with the hearings, we have 10 days to actually make a decision. And I'll just explain further in the next slides as well. So in terms of the actual clearance period for the 2017-2018 year, 61.98 were cleared in less than or equal to 60 days. In the prior year, it was actually a bit high because we had 73.53. And then we decided on 38% of those, we were able to clear those in more than 60 days. In the prior year, it was a bit less. But the average clearance period for the year was 70.66 days. In the prior year, it was a bit, we had 54 days, which was a bit less. So we were able to decide on matters quickly in the prior year than we did in this year. Then the graph also just shows the number of days just in a graph format, comparing 2016-17 and 2017-18. I'll ask Norman to just explain briefly on this slide.
So this slide is trying to explain why the merger clearances period is not as quick as it was last year. And there are two possible areas that could arise. One is that the Commission's investigative period seems to have increased from the normal 40 days, and we can tell that by the increase in the number of extensions that we grant them. For large mergers, if they want to use more than 40 days, they've got to get an extension from us. And so we had 63 extensions in this past year, 50, and the median extension period was 25 days as opposed to 15. And the maximum number was 247 days as opposed to 148. Now, although that is a longer time period, it doesn't necessarily mean that time period has been wasted. So I just want to caution that. It may just be that there is a number of more difficult cases which required more investigation. Then there was also a slight delay in our set down. We were supposed to set down, as Lorato mentioned, within 10 days of receiving the Commission's investigation report. We are slightly delayed this year compared to last year, but sometimes that's because the merging parties themselves are not ready. So as a statistic, it will reflect that we haven't set it down in 10 days, but often there's a reason for it, and usually it's because the merging parties are not available on the 10 days. They don't have senior management or their attorneys present. So that could be the explanation. We just give these as two possible reasons. We're not absolutely certain as to why there is a slight delay in the system. Lorato, back to you.
Okay. And then this graph just shows the turnaround times for our large mergers in terms of like the number of orders that we issued. This year we issued 121 mergers. Out of the 121, 108 were actually decided on the same day that the matter was concluded. Mm-hmm. And then 13 were plus minus, were within the 10 days. And in only one, we issued a decision in excess of the 10 days that's required. Okay, and then I'll hand over to Norman just to explain further on the measures.
Okay, in this section now, we're just going to talk about certain of the cases that would attract more interest. The first one here is a large international merger between two very large agrochemical companies, Dow Chemicals and DuPont. This was an international merger. It was heard by a number of jurisdictions worldwide. It created competition problems, and those jurisdictions imposed conditions on the merger, including divestitures, some of which actually impacted on us because the divestiture lessened the impact of the merger on the South African economy. But we were concerned about competitors of the merged company in the maize seeds industry and certain conditions revolving around licensing to allow entrance of competitors in South Africa. We imposed upon the merger. So although we benefited by the international conditions, we also imposed a condition to affect competition, or at least increase competition in the local market, which the merging parties, although initially reluctant to do so, agreed to the condition, so it was not opposed. The next slide is about, this merger is, although it says Chevron SA, it's really about the Caltex garages, which you are familiar with. The holding company is an American company called Chevron. It has decided to exit the South African market. It's a complicated story and not yet finished, but basically it is a merger in which there are two possible suitors who want to buy this company. And in the unusual situation, we have had to clear two rival bids for the merger. It's not often we have this kind of situation. It's quite unusual. But there's nothing stopping people, providing they're willing to pay the filing fee, from two rival bidders for a company to say, look, if we achieve this merger, will you clear it on competition and public interest grounds? So this is what's happened here. During this financial year, one of the bidders was a company called Sinopec, which is a Chinese company, which also wants to buy Chevron. And a number of conditions were imposed upon the Sinopec, largely through an agreement and negotiation with the Department of Economic Development. And they agreed to those conditions. The most significant, perhaps, is an agreement by Sinopec that if they succeed with the merger, they will invest 6 billion rand in improvements to the oil refinery, which Caltex has here in Cape Town, and a development fund for small business. The issue that came to us for decision was that certain of the what are called brand marketers, these are people who are small businessmen who own Caltex outlets, who were concerned that their security would be affected by the merger. They came to us. They asked for certain conditions from the merging parties, which they eventually agreed to protect them in case Sinopec changes the name from Caltex to another name. They will put some money in, and there were various other conditions to protect them. However, this merger, the reason why it's taken a strange twist is that another company called Off the Shelf, what is Off the Shelf? Off the Shelf is currently the minority shareholder, it's the empowerment shareholder in Chevron. They're headed by Mashudu Romano, who's a well-known businessman. They have also bid to get control of Chevron. That's a rival bid, so they put in a merger application as well, which we have recently cleared. It wasn't cleared in this financial in the past financial year, but it was cleared a few weeks ago. And largely they've agreed very, very similar conditions to those that that Sinopec had agreed to. So as, in terms of the public interest and the competition impact, the two different mergers would be neutral. There's now stage three, or act three of this situation. A large company called Glencore, a very large resource company, wants to buy 75% of Chevron. So in other words, Off the Shelf will be left, I think, with 25%. Glencore will take the 75%. And essentially, they're putting up the financing for this bid. So they have just notified their transaction. So there will be a stage three of this transaction for what is essentially the Caltex brand. So this has a long history. Move on to the next one. Another high-profile merger was the return of the Old Mutual Company, which had been listed in London, to South Africa. It also agreed to a $500 million development fund for small businesses and employment conditions. They were happy to give these. They were very positive about that. And so hopefully the return of Old Mutual is a good sign for our economy, that they've come back. And then I'll just go through You will recall about 18 months ago, there was the very large merger in which an international company, ABI InBev, bought and took control of South African breweries. That merger had certain conditions imposed on it, which has had subsequent impact on other corporations, which we decided in this financial year. The first was that one of the conditions was South African breweries had to sell their share in the Distell company, another big liquor company, to a third party. They eventually decided to sell it to the Government Employees Pension Fund. So that was a merger that we heard. It was a subsequent one. The other thing is that South African Breweries had a big shareholding in Coca-Cola, was its biggest shareholder. And because of conflicts of interest between ABI InBev, which has a international shareholding in Pepsi-Cola, South African Breweries agreed to sell its stake in the local Coca-Cola. And that has come about as well. It's for the time being sold its share back to the U.S. parent company of Coca-Cola, but Coca-Cola internationally has agreed that it will increase the BE shareholding as part of the conditions for the approval of the merger from 11% to 30%, which would bring it up, as I understand it, to where it was historically before all these mergers took place. So it's just interesting to see how the impact of one merger impacts on other corporations. Then, if I can just go to the Netcare Hospital Group, Akisa, we've actually had more or less at the same time three mergers involving two of the major hospital groups. Two of these mergers have occurred outside of this current financial year. One is still waiting a decision. We're going to finalize it probably in December of this year. That's Mediclinic buying two hospitals in Klerksdorp. There was another that's just fallen outside of this period in which Netcare bought a small hospital in on the West Rand. That was cleared subject to conditions. But the big one was this Netcare acquisition of a company called Akiso. Akiso was an independent company who specialized in hospitals for mental health patients. They were an innovative firm. There were concerns about the fact that there would be less competition, particularly in the Gauteng area, for patients requiring mental health services because Akiso had lower tariffs than did Netcare. The Commission actually initially wanted to prohibit this merger, and so we got involved in quite a lengthy hearing with economic evidence and medical aides coming along and giving evidence. And at some stage, midway during the hearing, Netcare agreed to sell their two mental hospitals in the Gauteng area, in the Johannesburg area. One is called Rand and one is called Bell Street, and they will sell that to a third party. And with that, the Commission was satisfied that the competition concerns in the Gauteng area for mental health services were taken care of. We were as well. So the merger was cleared subject to that. And there was also a future pricing condition imposed on Akiso. Next one is a... Okay. The next one is a merger in the mining safety market. There are firms, interestingly enough, who use plastic bags to protect mine shafts from collapsing. So they've developed some interesting technology, which I think is unique to South Africa, so that you don't need to use wood or steel and lowers the cost of mine safety. These are two firms who were vertically integrated. One actually makes the material, and the other actually installs it takes the bags and installs them. There was a merger. There isn't the downstream firm called Timrite has no competition for its particular product. The Commission was concerned about the merger and wanted to prohibit it. Again, we had a lengthy hearing and we approved the transaction, but we imposed certain conditions on the merger, both public interest, but also to prevent the loss of entry in the upstream market. So in other words, we analyzed the merger slightly differently to the Competition Commission, and we cleared it subject to certain conditions. Then just on the final thing on mergers, this year, unusually, we had a deal with two cases where people failed to notify mergers, failed to for different reasons. One is the last one first, Natal Witless Mandlamatla. Mandlamatla is a community newspaper in the KZN area, very well-known paper, been there for years, was bought by the Natal Witness some years ago, shortly after the Competition Act came into force. They didn't notify the merger. A rival company came along and said, these guys haven't notified the merger. They should have done so. There have been years of litigation around this. Eventually, Natal Witness got bought by the Naspers Group during thereafter, and they agreed to notify that they agreed to consent to the commission's consent order that they had failed to notify the merger when they should have, and agreed to pay a penalty. What then happened is that the rival firm, the Caxon Group, said the penalty is too low; it should be higher. So we had a case around whether the penalty was too low or not. We eventually decided that the penalty that the commission had suggested was an appropriate one in the circumstances. Mandlamatla was a very small paper, and in the circumstances in 2000, failing to notify was viewed less seriously than perhaps it might be now. If I can then go on to just show you some of the mergers, do get quite a lot of attention in the press, so we've just... go back to that slide. You'll see that that slide is just showing you the, you know, they get quite a bit of attention, and we'll get to later to the number of press clippings that we've got. Okay, if we now go into prohibited practices, as Lorato said in the beginning, the other thing that we deal with are prohibited practices. What are prohibited practices? They would be cartel cases or abuse of dominance cases. In this particular year of reporting, we had... issued 31 prohibited practice orders, same as in the prior year. We imposed penalties of 354 million rand. The prior year was 1.6 billion rand. So that's quite a large discrepancy. And the reason for that is in the prior year, there was the penalty imposed, which you may recall, on ArcelorMittal, which was 1.5 billion, which is by far the biggest we've had in our history. So that's why that figure looks so different to what it was last year. So if you were to extract the ArcelorMittal figure, the figures would look quite different. 70% of the penalties were imposed on the manufacturing sector. The highest penalty went to a firm called Autolive, which is an international firm, there was a penalty of 149.9 million. It's the world's largest automotive safety supplier, and admitted to rigging the market and bid rigging on tender for occupational systems for BMW and Volkswagen vehicles. Then other cartel matters. There have been several cases where we've got settlements from media companies who fixed the market's prices for outdoor marketing. Then another one, Berg River Textiles and Eyeway Trading. Two firms colluded on tenders to supply the Defence Force and the prison service inter alia, and so we found them guilty of collusion. One of them has agreed so far to pay the fine. The other one has appealed our decision but may withdraw that decision and settle with the commission. We don't know yet. The big interest one here is you'll see Citibank. Citibank is one of the banks charged in the foreign exchange bid rigging case the commission has brought against 21 different banks, both local and international. Of the banks, only one of the banks has actually settled with the commission thus far, and that is Citibank, and they settled a fine of 69 million rand. Then in relation to the flour cartel cases, which flew out of the bread cases, which we did a few years ago, it shows how sometimes these cases drag out before people settle. There were still four of the flour mills, these are some of the smaller mills, who have now agreed to a settlement with the commission, and fines were imposed on them. Therefore, the smaller firms, the fines varied between 4.2 million and 10.6 million rand. The next slide is a little unclear, but really it's just to show where... in which sectors most of the fines were, and most of the fines were actually in this year in the manufacturing sector, and I think that's largely taken up with the fact that the Autolive file was auto live fine was so large. And the sectors vary from year to year. I think what we need to do is to prepare one on a over a 5-year or even a 10-year period, because, you know, 1 year we would have had very high in the construction sector when those settled, and sometimes it's been in other sectors. So it's too soon in 1 year to judge where the problems are in a particular sector. Last slide here on the private practice cases, just to mention one or two things where interesting issues arose. One of the cases involved a construction company called Gurisich, which is based in KZN, which had provided a cover price to Grinica, one of the Avenge companies, and the case turned really around a telephone call. Agreement was reached in a telephone call to provide a cover price. So it was a question of the complete dispute of fact. The one firm got leniency, and so they testified for the commission, and the Gurisich person obviously testified for his own company. Who did one believe? And so this case was about that. Eventually, we believed that the commission's case was correct, and we found that Gurisich had contravened the act, and they were fined. Another case involves a merger, where a firm called Hoskin Consolidated Investments had asked the commission for an advisory opinion as to whether one of the transactions was a notifiable merger or not. The commission said this is a notifiable merger. The company disagreed, and they came to the tribunal for a declaratory order. The tribunal, my colleagues who were on that panel, said, we're not going to give you a declaratory order. It's inappropriate. If you don't think it's a merger, you can notify and then challenge the jurisdiction. They then took the tribunal's decision on appeal to the Competition Appeal Court. Competition Appeal Court overruled the tribunal. The commission is unhappy with that decision, has had the decision taken to the Constitutional Court, which heard the matter last month, and we await a decision. But the commission will probably, when it appears, say something more about that. What the commission's concern is, in other words, apart from all this litigation, which is perhaps more than the case necessitated, the commission is concerned that big firms will ask for an advisory opinion, and if it goes against them, come to us on an appeal, and that it prevents the commission from properly investigating the merger, because it doesn't have its investigative powers at the time that it has that it gets the advisory opinion, and it will have the unfortunate effect that the commission will be more reluctant to give advisory opinions if they're going to be challenged on this. So the proper procedure, the commission has argued, if you don't agree with us, at least notify the merger, and then there's a procedure in terms of our rules to challenge the jurisdiction before the tribunal, but at least allows the commission to investigate the facts. Performance review, and then I'll hand back to Lerato on this. Sorry, yeah, Lerato has just pointed out I've omitted one, the last thing. We had a rather unusual case, and she will be interested as the registrar for that. The commission brought a private practice complaint against various firms in the tyre industry, Continental, Goodyear, et cetera, et cetera. And the question was whether they had brought the complaint 1 day late, because they had to get it in by a certain date. And what happened was that the commission investigator brought the case in at 3:45 on a particular afternoon. Officially, the office hours of the registrar closed at 3:30. So these people, and there's something else in the rules which says if you bring it in after hours, you're deemed to have served on the next day. This would have made these firms, as it were, made the commission's referral out of time, and these firms, as it were, not have to face their trial. Anyway, so they challenged this the date of the referral in the tribunal. The tribunal said this rule is really for the benefit of parties that we close at 3:30, and if the registrar chooses to take something in later, that's not a problem. The tyre companies then took our decision on appeal to the Competition Appeal Court. I'm pleased to inform you the Competition Appeal Court decided last week that this point had no substance whatsoever, and the tyre companies are, as it were, excuse my pun, back on the road in terms of having to face their case. So you know, these are the points that firms which are well-resourced will sometimes take in our system, but pleased that one of the judges decided the other way. So hand over to Rata now.
Yeah, I'll quickly just go through our performance highlights together with Janine. On our APP, we've set about 25 targets. 14 of those relate to our core business and business processes. 4 of them relate to our stakeholder relationships. 7 on operational effectiveness. We've met or exceeded 16 of these targets. I'll quickly just go through the core business and business processes, and Janine will go through the rest. On the next slide, just on the adjudicative excellence, it shows the budget allocated and the budget that we spent on all the targets. And we've achieved 6 out of the 14, and then 6 we also partially achieved, and 2 are those that would refer to as we couldn't measure those, simply meaning that there wasn't activity in there that we could measure. And the stakeholder relationship, we have 4 indicators. We have achieved 3, partially achieved 1, and there isn't one that's not achieved. And in the accountable, transparent, and sustainable entity, we have 7 indicators. We've achieved or exceeded 7 of those. Janine will talk further on the budget in the next slide. On the adjudicative excellence, we've had about 213 matters in this year, and in the prior year it was 191, so our matters have gone up. I'm not sure about the percentage, but they've gone up a bit. And we've spent 157 days in hearings in this year, and the prior year it was a bit less, it was only 100. So we had a 40% increase in the number of complaint referrals that we've received from the Competition Commission. We've had 18.69 increase in the measures that we had in this year. And 29.84 of our measures were approved subject to conditions. We issued 206 orders. In the prior year, it was 179, and we issued 157 reasons for the matters that we've decided. In the prior year, it was 153. Okay. In terms of the volume, this graph or this just shows the number of matters that we had, the orders that we issued, the reasons that we issued, just in diagram form, comparing 2016-17 and 2017-18. And Naman will just explain a bit further on the next slide.
Some of the reasons for targets not being met are really go to capacity. In other words, we are getting supplied more cases than we're able to turn over within the periods that we've set for ourselves. Sometimes cases are particularly complex and a very long court record, and it requires, you know, the longer you are from writing the reasons, the longer time it actually takes to write a decision. And as the system becomes more sophisticated, the arguments become more complex, and it requires greater consideration. So that really is, one puts that all together, a reason that that we are not meeting some of these adjudicative targets. But at the end of the day, it's really about capacity, and I'll talk to this a bit more later on.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to cover the last two targets, stakeholder relationship and sustainable entity. So with regard to stakeholder relationships, we don't go into a lot of detail on the turnaround, the targets here, but we do highlight some of our interesting statistics around stakeholder relationships. So you'll see the number of visitor sessions on our website increased from just over 91,000 to nearly 94,000. We issued 128 press releases for 130 final decisions. Sometimes we issue one press release covers two decisions, so that's why it's less than the number of financial final decisions. We have now instituted a subscription process for our press releases, and we have over 3,800 subscribers. So there are different types of press releases that they can subscribe to, and that's why it's a substantial volume. But on average, it's about 900 subscribers per type of press release that we issue. And we had over 4,300 stories carried in the media, with 43.07% of them being online, and then the next one, print coverage. The print is slightly higher than online, and then the broadcast coverage. The next diagram or next slide just gives you a kind of overview when it moves. Sorry, this computer is very slow. Just gives you on a map, just shows you some of the top users of our website. So it's kind of the countries that one would expect: UK, France, Germany, China, USA, and South Africa. And then it just shows you the comparison between the number of users this year as opposed to the users last year. And, you know, that explains the figures that I talked to about earlier on. Then with regard to being an accountable, transparent, and sustainable entity, one of the things we focus on is trying to make the entity more sustainable through training. So within the year, we spent just over 117 days in workshops or conferences. That would be spread across all the people in the office. And we also try to focus on recycling. So the materials recycled increased by 45%. That takes out paper. Our paper came down because last year we moved and we had a lot of paper that we recycled, whereas in the financial year that we're reporting on, we had less paper. So we just give a little in our diagram. In our annual report, we give a little diagram that shows you how much of the paper we recycled, how many trees we saved, or how much energy we saved, just to illustrate the importance of recycling. One of our other big focus areas is on internships, and we have, as we've indicated to you before, a partnership with Harambee, who's an employment accelerator for our non-case management interns. Case management interns follow a different process. We go through the tertiary institutes, and there's an interview process for them, and they serve either a vacation internship, which is just during the June-July vacation, or otherwise some of them are, we currently have three interns there for 1 year. But what we also try to do is to encourage other young people to come and work in the tribunal. So within the other divisions like registry, corporate services, finance, we find positions for interns, and they can serve anything between 1 month to 1 year. So during the prior financial year, we had 14 interns, with 12 of them being African and 2 white, 6 of them being male and 8 being female. It costs us just over 924,000 rand, and if you add all the days that they worked in the tribunal, it's about 1,245. So it's a thing that we're quite proud of. Then I move on to the financial overview. And we were very pleased, again, for the second year in a row, to report that we had a clean audit, which means we had no findings whatsoever. It's better than an unqualified report. So we were very pleased with that. Then in terms of our income that we received during the year was just over 47 million, with the bulk of it coming from the grant, and the second biggest figure being from the filing fees that we receive for mergers that are being filed with the commission. We get a portion of those. And then other income relates primarily to small amounts that come in for photocopying and insurance refunds, things like that. Our expenditure was 47.47 million. Understandably, the bulk of it goes on personnel expenses, and then the others in decreasing order, with administrative being the next highest, and part-time members' fees professional services, training, and operating expenses. Professional services also includes the fees that we pay the DTI and the commission. So we pay the DTI for occupation of the campus, and we pay the commission for shared services. We also analyze our expenditure by objective, and understandably, the bulk of our expenditure goes on our adjudicative excellence goal, which is around our core business, so almost 55% of our expenditure is on that. And then the next highest would be on accountable, transparent, and sustainable entity. So that would relate mainly to expenses related to audits and to my office, the COO's office, and then stakeholder awareness. That's not a substantial expenditure on our part because we don't pay for advertising. We really just have a communications officer who performs that function. And then administrative expenses, which is not a goal, but it makes up the bulk of the expenses. And then I think you've seen this diagram before. We just add on an extra year when it moves through the funding analysis in the tribunal. So you'll see there with the blue graph being the expenditure one, and the next one being the grant and filing fees, and then interest received. So you'll see that our expenditure is increasing year on year, not substantially, but I think it is primarily related to the volume of our transactions. As you'll see, our transactions increased substantially between the prior year and the current year. And our grant is less than the expenditure that we have, and it's funded primarily by filing fees or some small interest. Currently we have sufficient funding, but it is in the next medium to long term going to be an issue where we either need an increased grant, we need an increased grant from the EDD to cover our expenditure. The next diagram is just a diagrammatical explanation showing you. Over the 2 years, the expenditure, just what we've talked about earlier, where you see it in terms of rand value as well as in terms of percentage. So again, in both years, the biggest expense is personnel, and then administrative expenses going down. There. So if there are any further questions, we can answer on those. And that is the end of my overview. Norman will take you through the last slide effectively before questions.
So really, the slide just deals with what are the challenges that we are facing at the moment, and perhaps what are the solutions. The biggest challenge, as I've mentioned earlier, is the fact that we are designed too small for the capacity that we have now, to put it simply. We started 20 years ago. We were designed with a capacity of 11 members, some full-time, some part-time. That capacity is just too small for the kind of caseload that we now face. So we need to expand the capacity, and as members are well aware, that is one of the proposals in the Competition Amendment Bill going forward, which will have three solutions in a sense to the capacity problem. It brings the total number from 11 to 15. It provides, very importantly, for the appointment of part-time members, which is the way that high courts deal with their capacity problems. And the third is that certain matters can be decided by one member only and not three members. At the moment, all our members have to sit on cases as three members, and that also is a strain on your capacity. So between the if those three meet with your approval as the committee, and Parliament's approval, that will go significantly to sorting out our capacity problem, if not completely. Obviously, that also has a financial capacity implication for the tribunal, because it will be more expensive. One of the questions you may ask is what if the amendments were to go through as envisaged, or with whatever tweaking Parliament does, will this increase the caseload on the tribunal? And I would say yes, in two areas primarily. One is the market inquiry, which is now going to be able to make binding decisions. That will be decided by the commission, as it were, as the court of first instance. But because those decisions are binding, the bill at the moment gives a right of appeal to the Competition Tribunal. Now, that would be We haven't really functioned as an appeal court beforehand, except for exemptions, and I think we've had one case in 20 years. So that would be, firstly, a novel experience for the tribunal members to face. But the records of these commissions inquiry are incredibly long. If we were to look at something like the health inquiry, and if that had made binding recommendations, then it would be a very, very long hearing and long adjudicative process to decide that. So it would be hugely capacity demanding of the tribunal. The second area are likely to be some of the new practices created, including the buyer power provisions, which may lead to not only the commission taking up new cases, but private complainants who are, as it were, feel threatened by the abuse of a buyer power may be willing to bring these cases, even as non-referred cases, to the tribunal, and we would have to decide them. So those are the big areas of activity. On merger front, there may be a increase in the complexity of merger adjudication, which may prolong that as well because of the slightly change in some of the focuses that will come down the line. So that really are the challenges that we face. So it's capacity of members and what the budgetary implications would mean, which is quite hard to model without knowing the way a new system kicks in at this particular stage. I suspect that those challenges will, obviously it's in your hands as Parliament as to when legislation goes through and in what form, but it would normally take for a case to come down the line to the tribunal from the Commission year and a half. So they're not challenges immediately in either the current or even the next financial year, but perhaps in the third year of the current MTF one would have to look at that. But perhaps one would have more information then and could model on it more likely. So that's really the end of our presentation. Thanks very much for listening to us.
Thank you so much to Mr. Manoim and the delegation for the presentation. We really appreciate this. As usual, we'd want to really commend you for the good work that you continue doing. And the fact that you're doing it so diligently is also quite impressive to us. We want to commend you for that too. The decision on the bill, amendment bill, especially on the effect part, lies with the president on what comes first. But we decide on the act, on whether to approve or not to approve. Yes, you are right there. But just when it comes to effect is the president's area, that one. Members, thank you so much. May we then interact with this particular presentation. I'm noting Mr. Atkinson, Ms. Dr. Cardo, and then Babu Bikinini and Mem Fulo. In that order, please.
Thanks very much, Chair, and thanks to Mr. Manoim and to to all of you for your presentation today. There were just two questions. The first is about the issue of personnel, because it always seems to be an ongoing problem. And as you said, 11 at the moment is actually too few for what you need to do. Are all your permanent positions filled at the moment? And are you at full strength as far as personnel are concerned? And then the second question was actually about the interns. What are the requirements? Do people have to be studying law to become an intern at the Competition Tribunal? And that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Atkinson. Dr. Kaidu?
Thanks, Chair, and thanks very much for the presentation. Congratulations on your clean audit. I've got a couple of questions for you. The first relates to your statement on page 9 of the annual report, and this is about the dispute that you had with Standard Bank around access to the record of investigation in the bank's collusion case. And obviously when you wrote your forward to the annual report, the courts hadn't sat to determine whether Standard Bank should in fact be given access to that record. But the tribunal decided, along with the commission, that it wouldn't hand over the record. And my understanding was that That was subsequently taken on appeal by Standard Bank, and it won its case with costs twice. I just wanted you to give us some insight into why you had taken the decision, or the tribunal had taken the decision that it did, that the respondent banks couldn't, in this case, rely on public access rights. Secondly, on page 10, you talk a bit about cartel cases which come before the tribunal, and you mention that they often end up in settlements, and you talk about this curious case of two firms that were accused of rigging a tender valued at 2,000 Rand to clear a magistrate's court of bees, which seems a bit bizarre. But it leads me to ask, is this really cartelistic behavior? I mean, one of the criticisms that one hears of the Competition Commission is that it has had a tendency of late to go after small firms because they are relatively easy to go after. Is this a trend that you yourself in the tribunal have identified? Is it a valid criticism? And then allied to that, I would like to know what proportion of firms accused of cartelistic behavior end up settling. You mention one particular case involving media companies that agreed to pay money into an economic development fund. What is that fund, who administers it, and how much money sits in it at the moment? And then finally, you've given us a sort of some insight into how you might be affected by the Competition Amendment Bill. So you've answered some of my questions in that regard. What I wanted to know specifically was how would the process envisaged for mergers involving national security considerations affect the tribunal specifically, and its time management when it comes to considering such mergers. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Chair, let's really welcome the report, Chair, and the clean audit. Says page 20, page 20, there's an article there of Glencoe, which talk about Glencoe. Slide 20. But it's not a lot, you know? It's just a clarity-seeking question. You still remember there's Sinopec, there's Chevron deal. There's also a Glencoe intervention. Now, mine, I wanted just to hear or to know that is not the Glencoe that we talk about on mineral issues. Or it's just merely a business transaction. You didn't look to other parts of it. I might talk more if you want me about the
plan. Clear? Is the question clear? He's asking if this is the same plan or that is in the...
Involve issues of mining. And
yeah, chemicals.
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
No. Okay. Thanks. Second
Thank
one.
You.
What has been the impact of the delays in the merging parties? Lastly, you don't think that we need to align statutory time frames with standard practice? Because you see, it overlaps these matters, the timing, and they want more time. Other matters are delayed. It's because of that that I'm asking that one. Thank you very much.
Thanks, sir. Babu Pekinini. Ma'am Fulo.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question just around, they are talking about interns. What I want to understand, after 12 months, what happens to these interns? Because I picked up that the norm now in South Africa, every company department is taking in turns. After 12 months, it's out next in the list. So I just want to understand, after the 12 months or whatever, a month, what is happening to these interns? And then what measures have you put in place to address the challenges of workload, you know, and also unavailability of part-time members, whether they're part-time or full-time, and then the unfunded vacancy, what, you know, what is happening about it? What are the challenges? But when I look at, I could also see that you're talking about the capacity of members in terms of workload, you know. You say it's insufficient. So which members? Part-time? Full-time members? And if capacity is lacking, what is happening to make sure that we do deal with that capacity? Thank you.
Thanks so much. Mem Fulu, Babu Kele.
No, thanks, Chair. I'm still on the internships. I just want to find out what is happening to the Indian community and colored community. Are they not applying to be part of this? Because it's only Africans and whites only here.
I just wanted to clarify whether it was for interns or more generally in the tribe. If we're interns, okay.
Thank you so much. From myself, I just want to understand from your side, Mr. Manoim and the team, how will the new act actually benefit you as the competition tribunal, the new amendments related to your work, how will they benefit you? The measures case review, out of the 37, for instance, you say you've approved out of the 37 that you have approved, sorry about that. Those that you've approved with conditions. Who oversees those conditions? Who made sure that the conditions are fully implemented? Yes, Mr. Manoim, you gave us reasons for the delays, especially in the issuing of either orders or any other related to that. I think my colleague beginning asked the impact of such delays. We just want to understand what effect does that have on the actual measures. There's on your strategic focus areas, performance, and performance against them. You, for instance, when I look at the adjudicative excellence, you're saying you have achieved, you have 14 indicators and you've achieved 6 and partially achieved another 6. And then you have number that could not be measured. I just want to understand what does that mean. Lerato, as we're explaining, I tried to listen, but I couldn't really get to understand what this column really wants to tell us so that you are able to understand. If you say there's a measure, there are numbers that could not be measured, and you are saying it's because which is currently 2, and I just want to understand what you mean by not being able to measure when you had an indicator, for instance. You can come up with an indicator and not be able to measure your own indicators. I just want to understand that. I really want to also applaud you on your accountability, transparency, and sustainability of your organization. What is actually catching my mind here is the 117.95 days spent improving knowledge in workshops and conferences. Where exactly is this done? Because that's very good, but I just want to know, you know, the how spread are you in terms of this, and just the type of people that you targeting, for instance, when you do so. I think that would be my last question.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. If I can perhaps just go through them as they were asked. Firstly, regarding our personnel, perhaps I should just distinguish between the tribunal members and our staff. The tribunal members are appointed by the president on the advice of the minister, so they are not, as it were, it's not our domain to appoint members. At the moment, we have all of our 11 members. Due to some personal circumstances for one of our 11 members, this person hasn't been available to us thus far for quite some time, unfortunately. It's going to change next month, and he will be more available. He had suffered a personal challenge, a tragedy after his appointment. So, but we that was for the period from the beginning of January last year. So it was just over 18 months, but he is going to now be available to us from tomorrow is his first time he'll be sitting on a hearing with us. But otherwise we have our full complement of members. As far as staff is concerned, we had some vacancies in our staff, which Janine can just mention, but those vacancies are either being filled, as in the case of our registrar and our head of corporate services, who started earlier this month, and there's one position outstanding, that's communications officer. Yeah.
Thanks. I think the vacant positions that we have funding for are currently being filled. So we've now, as Norman says, filled the head of registry position. We've filled the head of corporate services position, and that person started on the 1st of October. And we are currently just shortlisting for the communications officer. The unfunded position is one that we had on our organogram for a receptionist, which we haven't needed, but we put it on our organogram if we need it in the future. But we don't have funding for it from EDD or National Treasury, and we haven't needed it, but if we move to a new building, maybe we would. So it's not a vital position. It's not a position that we've fought for funding for. We are unable to increase our capacity significantly or change our structure because of the limit on government funding at the moment. So that area is unlikely to increase substantially.
Carry on. Perhaps just deal with the intern issue. There were a number of questions around that. What were the qualifications for interns? We have different kinds of interns. The one place where we have most of our interns are in what we call case managers. These are sort of equivalents of judges, clerks in our system. The requirement is you either have a law degree or you have an economics degree. So this year we have taken on three people. One of them is an economist, two others are lawyers. Basically, the way our system works, we stagger it. We take on people as VAT clerks initially during their final year at university, and if they look like they're working out, we then offer them a job as an intern the following year for 1 year. And what happens to them thereafter? Well, at the moment, the people who are on the one-year thing have all actually been, except for one person, have been offered a job for the following year. So they will go into, they will have another year's contract. And generally, we find that our case managers actually do get jobs. They often get jobs in another law firm. They're attractive to law firms because they've got the skills and they've got the experience. So two of our current case managers will, one next year and the one the following year, have been offered jobs by law firms. So they are finding places in the economy. Then there are other interns that we have in our administrative departments. And there we've actually, I think the history has been good, where people have actually started off as interns and have landed up actually getting a permanent job from us. Some of them we've done, we took in our human resources section a final year student who needs to have job experience, and she's been given a contract for
for
3 months as a job experience thing. She's still a student. So it depends on what we call them interns, but they serve a variety of different roles.
Yeah. I think also the interesting thing has been is that some, these interns all come from Harambee, so they have a number of skills that they've been equipped with beforehand. They come and they do an interview with us, and then we select, based on the interview, the best candidate. But we've had at least two of them recently who then applied for the position that they had been assisting us with, or a position that was created, and they turned out to be the best candidates compared to a wide range of candidates. So they were often offered permanent positions. So I think I can think of at least four who started as interns and then landed up being permanent employees of the tribunal. And then, for example, the one that Norman's talking about, it's a young woman who's studying an HR diploma, and they're in a catch-22 position. They have to have the practical experience to get work, and they don't get work because they haven't got the practical experience. So we gave her a position. We'll probably extend her to the end of December so that she at least then gets her work experience and then can go out on and have the CV. So we're currently doing an analysis of what's happened to all the interns we've had over the period to see where they've landed up, and then we'll write a little narrative on that. Just with regard to Indians, there's nothing stopping us from getting Indians. I think the thing has just been there haven't been many Indians applying. I can't think offhand. We've definitely had Indian and coloured case interns, because some of those are now full-time employees, but presently there aren't any who came through the process. So it's just whoever applies we go through. We haven't had a focus on any particular group.
Okay, then if I can go on to the questions in firstly about the Standard Bank case. The Standard Bank case, I think, has been misreported in the press. Standard Bank case, just for the background of the other people, in the course of the Forex case against 21 banks, one of the banks, Standard Banks, has applied to get hold of the commission's record. It's not the tribunal's record. The tribunal doesn't have the record either. It has applied for the tribunal to get the commission's record. He's the only one of the banks that has actually brought this application. There was a prior precedent of the Competition Appeal Court which says that any member of the public can get the Commission's record after the Commission has referred the complaint within a reasonable time. So we had to make a decision as to whether Standard Bank wanted to get the record within, I think it asked it for 21 days. The Commission was reluctant to give the record. And so we had to make a decision as to what a reasonable time was. We said that given the complexity of the case and the that was there, and the fact that Standard Bank hadn't given any reasons for getting this record earlier, it hadn't yet filed an answer either, that a reasonable time was when the Commission makes discovery in the case. That is the decision that they went on appeal to the Appeal Court. The Appeal Court has said a reasonable time should not be related to the litigation because of the public interest right, and it should just be in a reasonable time, and because the Commission hadn't given any alternative time, it should be 21 days. The Commission has since appealed that decision to the Constitutional Court. So that's the issue around Standard Bank. They're not asking for our record. We don't have that, and that's where we were came into this history of this litigation. Then you asked about the Bees case. I think to say two things. There'd be two approaches. This is really the Commission's prosecutorial policy. We as the tribunal must decide any case that's been brought before us. We can't not decide the case. Should they have brought the bees case? Well, I think the commission is the body to ask it. It's not the biggest case that's emerged. But on the other hand, if people break the law, you can sort of have a kind of New York broken windows approach and say, well, if you break the law, it must be enforced, so people send a message. And then the question is, you know, what is the penalty? I do think that there are some firms that one could settle with rather than continuing the litigation, but really it's the commission's prerogative as the prosecutor to decide on that and whether wanting to send a message to people about not breaking the law. What is happening as a trend is that there is bid rigging between big firms and small firms. So the case of Berg River Textiles that I put over there was when a large manufacturing firm did a deal with a small intermediary firm, a BEE firm with better BEE credentials than that, to rig a bid. And I think that's a very serious thing, and I think the Commission is correct to, as it were, prevent the usage of the privilege of the BEE preferment to be used by traditional white firms to, as it were, rig a bid, because you've got better empowerment. The reason it happens is that nobody's certain how much the empowerment factor would qualify in terms of the price. So they, as it were, rig two bids, you bid, I bid, and they actually filled in the price for the BE firm as to what price they should charge. So the entire policy of BE was undermined here quite cynically, and I think the Commission, nobody else is enforcing against this. The Commission is right to bring these cases because they are serious. They subvert a public policy in tendering. There might be some small firms that are implicated, but often there is a big firm that, you know, collusion takes more than one. There's always at least two in a collusion case. So it's a matter of prosecutorial policy, and there'd be different views on that, to be fair to the Commission. They feel that the message must be sent that this conduct, however small you are, can't be tolerated, and the issue is then how you remedy that as opposed to not taking on those cases. The next issue was what the national security proposal in the amendment bill will have as an implication for the competition tribunal. The issue, I think the main issue is that there will be a delay in mergers coming to the tribunal if the current proposal, that there is a period of time up to, I think it's 60 days, for this national security issue to be addressed first. So I don't think it's going to impact on us as an institution. It will obviously impact on the firms involved in the merger, and it may create, as it were, an incentive for the firms to say, look, we've already waited 60 days, you as the competition authorities must hurry up. There is a possibility that there may be some overlap between the national security consideration and the public interest consideration in the Act, which may lead to, as it were, jurisdictional issues between that committee and doing its work and what we're doing in our work. But we are always, as it were, coming after the fact, so it doesn't have a direct impact on us in terms of us as the institution as I see it at the moment. I just asked then about the Glencore. It is the Glencore, the well-known Glencore, and a mining company who are the bidder in the third round for the Chevron assets, together with the off-the-shelf company, which is there, will be their BE partner. Then what is the effect of, I think two members have asked about, what has been the effect on mergers because of the delays? What we've tried to do is to make sure that the orders come out within the closer period as we can, because it's the order, it's the absence of an order that prevents people implementing a merger. You can't implement a merger until you've got an order. So what we've tried to do is to bring out the orders within the time period insofar as we can, but the reasons might come later. So if I could just give as an example this Tim Wright tough bag case there that I mentioned there, this mining safety bag. We brought out the order within the period required, but the reasons came out sometime later. But basically the parties were not affected because they were able to go on with, they knew what the conditions were and they got their merger cleared, and so they got the reasons later, because the reasons are what takes the time and requires more work. And so what we've tried to do as a strategy is to, given our capacity constraints, is to say, what are the urgent things that we must decide? and re-mergers and getting the orders out, what are the things that are less urgent and let them fall off and become, which people are not sitting there waiting for us? Are there cases, for instance, where people might want to appeal a decision and need a decision earlier? Those are the cases that we try to try and prioritize. So we operate, as it were, as a hospital would do it in its emergency rule, and try and apply a kind of triage approach to cases and decisions to try and deal with that problem. We were asked about where's the workload problem. Is it part-time or full-time? I think it really is both. Often our panels are a mixture of part-timers and full-timers. It would be nice to have our part-timers a little less part-time, but they are people in private jobs and they have other priorities other than our own. So I really think that the amendments are really are going to be our solution to this capacity problem, because we can't, as it were, outsource the tribunal function. Three people have to hear a case and they have to decide the case. It cannot be outsourced. We do try to use our case managers to help us with quite a lot of the research, to help us with doing initial drafts of some of the writing in some cases, but at the end of the day, members have to take responsibility for their statutory duty, and we can't get around that. Chair, you asked us on the benefits to us on the Amendment Act. I've already advertise the one, and I don't need to bore you with that anymore. I think in certain provisions there is going to be greater clarity. I'm thinking of the excessive pricing and the predatory pricing definitions. I think some issues around mergers have got greater clarity. So that will, as it were, you know, up until now we've had disputes about what certain things have meant. And I think what the Act has done in certain places is to give clarity. It also obviously create new areas where there isn't necessarily going to be clarity, and there will be contested cases around what they mean. Some of the, you know, the buyer power provisions would be an example of that. And also, once we, as a procedural issue, the when we get the market inquiries, looking at that will be, I don't want to say it's a burden for the tribunal, but it's a challenge to the tribunal. I think there are virtues in the, if I can just identify one area, I think what's missing in the legislation is what we call the non-collusive oligopolistic behavior. In other words, to be less technical, you've got a few guys in an industry, you can't prove that they met in a dark room and came up with an agreement, but the industry is not behaving competitively. And I think this is an area where the market inquiry is going to be very, very important. And it needs to actually be able to have some teeth. And I think that, you know, the amendment now gives it some teeth instead of just simply being a recommendatory body. And it has been shown to work in jurisdictions like the UK, where they've done interesting things in the banking sector. And I think it's a weakness in competition legislation where you have this gap. And it's a serious attempt to cure that gap without making the firms pay penalties. Yes, they've got to change behaviour, but they won't be subject to a penalty as they would with a collusion case. So I think that is honestly a benefit to the tribunal per se, but I think it's a benefit to the public as a whole in having a more competitive economy. And I think that is this is an area which is noticeable in our South African economy. Chair, in answer to some of the questions, I talked about the impact of the delays on the firms. The workshops, we have had workshops both for, I think we should distinguish, Janine can perhaps just talk about the workshops for staff. We have workshops we run for both the case managers and the tribunal members. We run an annual workshop once a year where we get an international speaker to come along, and he does presents international cases, but he also does a peer review of our own cases, and he says, I've looked at your decision, this is what I comment about, and that's very, very useful, and that's attended by all the tribunal members and all our case managers. And then we also attend, we send people to workshops organized by the OECD in Paris, that's twice a year, and also by the International Competition Network, and that's organized everywhere in a different place. We had it in India this year, which is where I attended, and there will be an ICN workshop in South Africa this year. The Commission will talk about it today, the organizer. That's an international workshop in Stellenbosch at the end of October, and we'll send all our case managers there. I don't know if you want to talk about the staff's workshop.
Yeah, I think that figure relates to all within the tribunal, that training that they attend. So the bulk of the training would take place amongst the case managers and the tribunal members, but from the administrative support side, they would be going to various things. There may be computer courses, there may be legislative courses, like, for example, on new accounting standards or new tax legislation. So it's a wide range of interventions that people attend.
Chair, sorry, you asked about why in two instances there were no targets. If we had targets, why we didn't measure? Lerotta is just pointing out to me that the reason is that there were none of those cases came out during that particular year. So I think that's why we... It could be explained a bit better.
What it is, for example, we have a target for issuing of reasons in a particular category of case. And if there were no reasons issued, then we can't measure it. So it's you can't measure something that hasn't happened. So that's what that one relates to.
You missed something out of it. Yeah, I take the point, Chair. Thanks. It can be better explained.
Because our researcher wanted me to clarify something for her, and I don't know. I feel like it's a bit preemptive. So, but if she's comfortable that I should leave it, it's fine. Thank you. This is mainly because this is our meeting, not theirs. So she normally uses the opportunity that I'm here, and then she can ask questions. Are there any follow-up questions, members? You're all fine. You can. We still have time. You can ask that question.
Thanks, Chair. I just was curious about one case that you mentioned in your introduction, which was the case of Game and it not being able to sell fresh produce in its stores. I wanted to get some insight into your thinking on that, because you found not in favour of it, as I understood it. But you also mentioned that these particular cases of restrictive vertical arrangements are quite rare. Is there anything in the new Competition Amendment Bill that would make it easier to prosecute those cases on the Commission's behalf? But my question really revolves around your thinking, the Tribunal's thinking, in finding not in favour.
Thank you, Dr. Kairo. Any other question? Okay, you may respond.
I think that's a very interesting question, because I think it does bring into the new competition bill the market inquiry, because the issue that Game had taken up, Game is a subsidiary of the Massmart group, and it said that in a number of supermarkets in which it is present, it is not able to sell fresh food because of agreements that some of the big supermarkets, and they said ShopRite, Spar, and Pick and Pay, have with the landlords. Now, where the case faltered, there was a technical point taken, is it wasn't clear that there was always this restriction there. So the case wasn't well, they'd taken the case as a national prohibition rather, a national problem rather than a particular area. In other words, they didn't say that in this area in Cape Town or Johannesburg they can't get into that local market. So it was a case that was quite difficult to get a handle on. And in some areas, that in fact, there wasn't a prohibition on them, or it hadn't been exercised against them. And what they really wanted was to be in all areas at all the same time. So I think the problems were it was a slightly overambitious case. And the second thing is that there was competition, as it were, between other of the big players who were in the same market. So it wasn't necessarily clear that the exclusion of a number three coming in was necessarily going to have an effect on competition. That case wasn't sufficiently made out. So that really was what went wrong with the game case. It wasn't sufficiently... They had an opportunity to amend their case, and this was second time round, and they hadn't, frankly, strengthened the case before them. The Commission had decided not to take the case because it's running a market inquiry in the retail sector and felt that they would really want to look at these leases first before they took the case on itself. So the Commission didn't want to take the case on. Where does it fit into the Amendment Bill? Well, the Amendment Bill is that the market inquiry is actually a good area for the market inquiry, because this thing doesn't quite fit into any of the existing provisions of the Act to make that case. But it may well be that one could look at this whole conduct of restrictive leases in supermarkets and make a binding agreement under the Competition Act. So I think it's a very good example of an important intervention that the market inquiry provisions will allow, which the current Act does not allow.
I take it that is covered. Okay, no further questions or follow-ups. There's this question around the amendment on 3 versus 1 person deciding on cases. You understand it?
Yes.
Can you clarify to us why 1 instead of the current 3? Why are you minimizing that? When before you used to have 3 people, now you want 1.
Chair, as I recall the bill, and I cannot recall the exact wording, it will only apply in certain procedural cases. For instance, some of the cases involve the procedure of discovery. In other words, should one side have given the other side the other documents? These are not cases that require, as it were, a full panel. They're often quite technical, and one person can deal with that. So the feeling is that it's still in the discretion of the chair of the tribunal to decide whether it should be a one-person case. And often one will simply say to the parties, do you agree that one person should just decide this? And they would say yes. So those are the sort of cases, but they will not be deciding the big cases, whether to approve a merger or not a merger, or whether to find a prevalent practice and issue a fine. It's confined really to procedural issues.
Thanks for clarifying that. May we then take this opportunity. Lerato, we know that you're leaving too soon. We thought we were still enjoying your being there within the Competition Authority. I'm in the tribunal. All we can say is thank you very much for really agreeing to serve the people of South Africa, especially in that very technical area of work. Being a young lady serving there with the giants, I know that it could be very challenging sometimes, but really we enjoyed, you know, interacting with you and hearing your voice each time the tribunal comes and to account. We can only wish you well in your future endeavors. We hope that you will still be serving our public wherever you are, because you are going to the entrepreneurial area. We're hoping that you'll use the experience that you held in the tribunal to the good, and you'll be able, you know our concerns, you'll be able also to do more for our people, as we still need people like you to help, especially to transform our economic sector.
Sorry, thank you, Chair. And let me take this opportunity as well just to thank you for your patience and for literally for everything. I have really learned a lot from attending these meetings. I mean, 20 years in the tribunal, as young as I was then, I mean, I think the experience that I've gained, it's not an experience that I can buy with money. And this is the experience that I will take forward. And I was actually pleasantly surprised that on one of the groups that I'm in, there was a suggestion from someone that why don't we fix prices and stop hiring out whatever we're hiring out to different people at different prices. And I didn't have to say anything, but other people actually jumped in to say, no, it's actually against the law. So I was very happy that people are aware that there is a Competition Act and how it operates. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you very much. And the experience that I've gained, I will definitely take forward.
Mostly welcome. Thank you also to Mr. Manoy, Mem Titlek, for taking, because really this is the type of, you know, outcome we need when you're working with people. And I think Lerato is as confident as she is today because of working with you and gaining experience from the elders. It really helps. We want to thank you also for what you've imparted to her, because surely it will serve our nation much better. We would like to thank you for the work that you are doing also to our nation. It's not quite a popular work, I know. You have sometimes to fight with people because they are conflicting interests, and you have to make sure that you balance and satisfy everybody, which is not an easy work to do. Thank you, members, for being here and also for participating, especially in the beginning of this particular BRRR process. We are going to meet the ITEC after lunch. And then immediately after lunch, we're going to be getting a briefing from the Auditor General. That will be quite a short briefing. I already met with them this morning. It's quite a short briefing from the Auditor General, if you don't mind, so that you get to know how every entity, including our department, has performed during this the previous financial year's audit. I guess this is the time for us to break for lunch, and we'll meet at 2 o'clock. The meeting stands adjourned, partially. Thank you.